Today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Cash and Carry Kitchens. We design, craft and install beautiful kitchens. cashandcarrykitchens.ie.
Email todaycb at rte.ie.
I have the author and broadcaster Moncon McGann with me in the studio. Hello to you.
Hello, nice to see you.
Lovely to have you with us. Now, you're here to tell us about your new book, which is released today, a beautiful thing that you have in front of you. And it tells us about the hidden history of Ireland's connection to Iceland, which I'm willing to bet very few of us know anything about.
Yeah, I hadn't. Like, even a year and a quarter ago, it just wasn't on my radar. I was invited to go over to the Iceland Writers Retreat to teach there. And you go into the National Museum. And you know the way here we have the bog bodies in the National Museum? Well, there they have two skeletons. Mm-hmm. And one is a skeleton that was, like, perfectly preserved of a woman from the first settlers. So you can imagine, Iceland was only settled in the 10th century, maybe the very end of the 9th century. So they have a skeleton of one of the first settlers, a woman, and then a warrior beside her. Okay, and the tour guide is bringing it around, says, okay, this woman led Residues of lead were found in her teeth, which means she was either born in Ireland or Scotland. I thought, okay, that's interesting, like that this woman. And then the body next to him, the warrior with the sword beside him, they said DNA has now shown that his mother was Irish and his father was Norse. So I suddenly started looking into it and realizing, like, Iceland are now the experts at DNA because they have this enclosed community on that island for so long. And when they did the DNA study, the female, the mitochondrial DNA on the mother's side and then the Y chromosomes on the father, they found that 60% of the settlers who first arrived, you know, in Iceland 1,100 years ago were Irish. 60%.
Mm. God, it was a long way for them to travel, wasn't it?
Wasn't it?
Up and over to the right, okay?
Exactly, yeah.
And
it wasn't just like, we have this idea, oh, they were slaves, the strong Vikings came and got us. Yeah, but no, what they're finding now with the DNA is actually 20 to 25% of those were men. So a lot of these were maybe whole clans or families or individuals in Ireland deciding, meeting the Vikings, who obviously had been living here for 100 years, you know, the Vikings had been in Ireland since the early 9th century. And so they decide, okay, let's go up with them. So clearly there were slaves taken, but there was also families in Ireland who decided to go. And it means that the first languages that those waterfalls and rocks and glaciers were hearing was Irish, or Middle Irish, which was the Irish that we were spoken at the time, and Irish mythology and Irish spirits and Irish mindset.
Do we have any clue as to why people would have made that decision voluntarily to make the arduous journey to go to Iceland?
I mean, you can imagine, like, the Viking longships. They were clearly explorers. They wanted to go out and colonise new places. The Irish, we had these little inshore boats. We didn't really, you know, decide to want new colonisers. So I suppose we were inspired by the Vikings. But the reason the Vikings went was because Irish monks had been there, either at least from the 8th century and maybe a bit earlier again. Because now in the last 10, 20 years, archaeologists along the entire south of Iceland are finding these caves, these caves that have been carved out into the soft rock with these rock markings on it, mainly Christian crosses, that are identical to the Christian crosses found in Irish and, you know, Scottish. When I say Ireland, I mean, sorry, the Hebridean Islands of Scotland and Irish, because it was the same culture, same language, same everything at the time. But anyway, these were all along the south coast of Iceland, we're finding these carvings and these Christian markings. So monks were constantly going over there. They weren't settling it. They would just go up there in the same way as they went out to Skellig, you know, looking for remote hermitages. Because you remember, the Irish monks were inspired by the desert monks of Mount Sinai. This whole idea that to be a true Christian, you had to go into the wilderness.
Yes.
So Irish monks, as you said,
a remote and quiet life.
Yeah, they were leaving Donegal, heading up long past the Faroes, getting to Iceland, spending time, and then coming back again.
But when you were surprised to see the link was there, then you started to explore it. But then when you were in Iceland, you kind of went, well, this makes sense, given who I'm meeting and who I'm seeing and what it feels like.
Yeah, it's like, you know, in every way, I started looking, I think, if there is 60% of the DNA, then surely there must be, you know, symbols of that, signs of that in their appearance. And there are, like, you can see the sort of the freckles and the blue eyes and the pasty face and the sort of mousy hair and the slight crunched back that we see in the west of Ireland just facing off the wind and the steep slopes of the mountains that you don't really associate with Scandinavia or with the Norse cultures. And then you start looking at the place names and you're saying these place names that were, some of them, you know, were there from the very beginning, from those first settlers, the Irish and the Norse who came, whatever, from 875 AD onwards. So for, you know, 1,100 years. And you'll have place names like in the west, in the far northwest of Iceland, there's places called Írafell and Írafellsbunga. And Ír is just Irish, so fell is mountain. So Irish mountain, Irish fells, Bunga would be the Irish, again, Bunga is in elevation. So another high point that the Irish were. Down in the south, you'll find these places called Papai and Papai. And Papa just means Pope, Papa, you know, the Pope. Mm-hmm. So because they thought if their leaders, you know, if the Vikings group had some tribal elder, they'd meet these Christians who said, oh, my leader is the Pope. And so they would call them, these are the people who are followers of the Pope. But then again on the west, you'll have a place called like Patrick's Fjordr, where a bishop who was, you know, following the lineage of St. Patrick turned up. He was probably from the Hebrides. But again, Ireland, the Hebrides, it's the same culture. You have Kieronsvik, named after St. Kieron. The other place to look is in people's names. And a lot of Iceland, they don't really know about this, you know, because...
Well, we don't know about it either, but we're learning.
I know. And it's interesting, like, do we have a responsibility? If we settled a land that was entirely bare, nobody was ever there, uh-huh, except a few Irish saints, you know, until, as said, 875 AD. And if we settled it with our myths, our stories, our place names, our like goddess-centered view, you know, this sort of the Queen Maeve, the Queen Anya, that was the mindset we brought. And that's all gone now, because now you have this strong male Nordic idea of Odin and, you know, Thor and all. Do we have a responsibility maybe to go up to them and say, actually, you know, actually, Bjork, you have our goddesses. Bridget is your goddess too.
So tell us about the names then that you come across that exist today that you can look at and go, well, actually, that's an Irish name.
Yeah, exactly. Now, they're not totally common, but there are in certain families Irish, families who have preserved Irish names. Again, they don't know it. And in the sagas and in the old lore, you'll have loads of examples. But like a classic example is the keyboardist of Sigur Rós is Kjartan Sveinsson.
Svensson. Right.
Now, I don't think he knows this, but Kjartan, it's an Irish name, Kjartan, it's from Murchartig. It's the, Murchartig is the mariner, the sea chart, you know, Murchart, the sea chart. So his descendants were obviously sailors, navigators. He doesn't know that. You also find
We'll tell him.
Exactly.
We'll make sure he knows.
There's a famous film director and actor that the Icelandic people are very proud of called Baltasar Kormakur. And Kormakur is Cormac. Cormac Mach, the son of Cor. Cor is either from Carabod, the chariot, or Cor, the crane or the heron, who was a shamanic pagan figure, or Carabas ship. There's Neil in Neil's saga. Neil is obviously an Irish name. It means champion. Muel Kirkig, which would be Muel, the follower, the devotee of Kirkig. But probably there's even the patron saint of Iceland. There was a lot of Irish monks who brought Christianity to Iceland, but the patron saint is Thorlacher Thorhalsson, and Thorlach is from that name, Thorlach, you know.
Thorlach, yeah, of course. And when you start to explore this, and I'm sure you spoke to historians, genealogists and all sorts of people in Iceland, did they agree with your theory? There was no argument there.
No, scholars are only beginning to really accept in the last few years. There was some good work done on in the 60s, but it's really the DNA. Because Iceland decided they were going to be the, you know, sort of a frontiers of really, describing and decoding an entire DNA of a population. They have the best DNA records. Just because there's two books called the Island Book and the Landnámabók Book, which describes and documents every settler who arrived in the late 9th and early 10th century. So it means they have the book, they have the DNA, they can build up a picture. And then they start thinking, what's with all these Irish people? Mm-hmm. Why is there 60% Irish people?
Well, you have the immutable truth in the DNA, but also the fact that you have those valuable written records, right?
Exactly, yeah. There's something that's turned, like there's one saga that it like sort of, you know, captures it better called the Laxdæla saga. So it's like an epic story from the 9th to the 11th century of this family in the northwest of Iceland. And the great-grandson of the main person who sets it up, he's a Ketil Björnsson or Flatnose, Ketil Flatnose. His great-grandson Horskildr goes to Norway and buys a slave from Gilli the Russian. Gilli is Gilla, the Irish word for servant of. So it was like Mokkila Padraig or Mokkila Owen or Mokkila Aspen.
Gilla. Yeah. So he was Russian-Irish.
He was dressed in the finest Russian hat. So he was Irish. But he always wore a beautiful Russian hat.
They said
a
fur hat. Russian. Yeah. That reason.
And
right.
So Horskildr buys this slave from him, brings her back as his concubine to Iceland. And at the age of, they have a baby together. Okay. She's entirely mute. She doesn't say anything about who she is. And then at the age when she gives birth to a boy. The boy is 2 years of age, and suddenly Horskildr hears the mother talking to the baby and realizing, God, she can talk, but she's talking in Irish. The baby only has Irish. He hasn't learned a word of Norse, the language that was going to become Icelandic in the future. And so he realizes, my God, and he asked her, what's her name? And she says her name is Melchorca, so an Irish name. But she says she is the daughter of an Irish king called, what's his name? Murchartan. And that seems to be Murchartig MacNeill, one of the great O'Neill dynasties. And then the whole story is when the boy becomes of age, he goes back on to Ireland and he comes shipwrecked. And the local Irish fishermen are about to take everything he has, but he speaks Irish to them and they realise he's one of them. And then the king, Murchartig, hears that this Irish-speaking Viking warrior, and he brings him in and he loads. But there's loads of those stories in the sagas. They're full
so
about Ireland.
He comes back, he's returning royalty to Ireland.
Exactly, yeah, yeah.
So what other evidence then did you find? So you mentioned the caves.
Yeah.
And tell us a little bit more about that, about the inscriptions that can be found there that leave some clues for us.
Well, even the very fact that we have all these stories. So let's say in terms of Northern Europe, like Southern Europe, we have the Greek and the Romans wrote down. We have their oral tradition was eventually written down, the Greeks and the Romans. And that's why we can read, you know, Ulysses and the Adventures of Odysseus. But we don't have anything for that for Northern Europe because the Dark Ages came and wiped it away. But Ireland, as we know, the monks wrote all our stories down that go back two and a half, three, maybe 4,000 years in some stretches. The reason that we know anything about Norse culture was because it was all written down by the monks in Iceland. So we seem to have passed that idea on to the Icelandic people to record the old oral literature. So the Norse, the only reason we have a sense of their stories is because of that. And it really ties in because then, as you say, when the archaeology is doing research, is going out and seeing that these rocks, in one way it's just archaeology, but then they can tie back to the old oral literature that was written down by the monks, and they build up these this whole sense of what's going on. So let's say there's about 170 caves on the southern coast and then a bit inland in the southwestern lowlands. And these were where the Irish monks from, you know, 7th, 8th century, more likely mostly the 8th century, were coming up every year building these caves, and we find remnants, at least in the Íslendingabók book, you know, the first account of the settlers. They say that when they arrived, when the first Vikings arrived with their Irish slaves and co-settlers, they would find evidence of the Irish, Irish holy books, Irish chalices, Irish things. But what we see now is these inscriptions in the rock walls, and we can date the inscriptions because the dust that came off when they were, you know, when they were carving out, the dust that came off the rock, you can now equate that with the ash that fell on a volcano. So you can actually get a very, very direct date to it. But you're seeing it's the exact same carvings that you're finding in the West Highlands and the islands. So in the Iona, obviously in the island of Iona, which was so linked to Ireland, and St. Malicia's cave in Arran, in the Arran of Scotland.
And mythology as well.
Yeah.
Shapeshifters and fairies and spirits and all that good stuff that we love here.
Yeah, I think when you think of Ireland and Iceland, we do have a sense that we're the two people who still believe in fairies, or we did until recently. And we're the two people who have actually brought roads, moved them a different direction to allow for a fairy stone or fairy.
So not to disrupt things.
Exactly, yeah. And we're the only ones. And it's no coincidence, of course, because our mindset, our belief in fairies, you know, was preserved. So we know we in Ireland, we have Naisheog and Idina Maha, we have all the different fairies. There they have the Landfetir, which are the land beings, then the Huldra, which are the hidden ones, then the Underjordiska, which are the underworld ones, just like our fairies are in the underworld. They have the Alvar, the elves. And then even they have the Cunig Madra. So the first settler, when the king of Norway was deciding he was going to move up to, or the king of Denmark, go up to Iceland, he sent this sorcerer up to talk to the land spirits of the area. And he found that each one had, they were like flying birds, there were magical big cattle, there were giants, just like we have in our stories. And some of them could be because we're both Indo-European cultures. We had these stories long ago. But there's too many coincidences.
Yes. It's a shared culture.
Exactly.
What you've established in the book. Now, I want to tell people what the name of the book is because it is available from today. It's out now and it's called Ireland in Iceland, Gaelic Remnants in a Nordic Land by Máchan McGann. I should also mention that you're going to be on the telly soon. Two episodes of Listen to the Land Speak coming up on RTE in July.
Exactly.
Which people can look out for. How are you? Because I know you've spoken about your cancer diagnosis. You went through a rough enough time of late, didn't you?
I did. I had a year and a half of sort of dealing with the prostate cancer that was a tiny bit in my bone and in my lymph. And it's interesting because as we were filming that documentary, The Listen to Land Speak, I was sort of dealing with it. So you have me out in beautiful places in the Iron Islands or something, you know, coming to terms with illness. Mm-hmm. But luckily, prostate cancer is so easy to deal with now. I did my 4 weeks of radiation. I did a year of this hormone therapy, which blocks the testosterone, as everyone knows now because of the Joe Duffy show. And so that sort of gives you a clean bill of health, you know, for the moment. I'll keep taking blood tests and keep checking.
So you're good now?
I think I'm perfect. Yeah, I think I'm perfect. It's just we're really lucky with what prostate cancer is now, with that you can test it in the blood, and then that these sort of hormone stopping therapies really sort of control it.
It's great to hear that, but I'd imagine when you were filming, you probably felt pretty rough, right? I'm guessing.
I did, because I didn't know what was coming. But actually, the radiation was a walk in the park. I did it in St. Luke's in Rathgar. They were gorgeous. The medication, it does stop your testosterone, so that there's so many different side effects to that it's tricky. But maybe looking back on it, I just think like it was an amazing growing experience.
Really?
I had a great year and a half. Me and my partner did. Yeah.
Well, it's great that you're doing well. Great to hear it. And we wish you the very best with an intriguing book, another intriguing book. And we should say the illustrations in that book are beautiful.
Oh, yeah. A.O. Regan did them. Oraganillo. Beautiful. Yeah. Thank you for that, Claire.
Ireland in Iceland, Gaelic Remnants in a Nordic Land by Mancon McGann. Thank you very much for coming in. We'll take a break back after this.